UK Wine Show, show number 161. Nicola Jenkins on recycling from Rat. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and it's show number 161 for the 19th of June, 2009. Well, it's been a pretty mixed week, weather-wise anyway. I was hoping to do an interview with Berno Goez, Chief de Cave at Moët & Chandon, but sadly, things conspired against me. So this week in the spotlight, I'm going to recap a fascinating talk that he gave about assembling his champagnes, and some interesting tidbits I picked up. In the interview, we're going to be talking with Nicola Jenkins from RAP, this time about alternative packages to glass, and RAP's view on these from a waste management position. This week is a mystery grape week, so you need to work out what you think the mystery grape is from the clues I'm giving you. This week we're talking about a rather fashionable Spanish white wine-making grape. It produces perfumed and elegant wines, often with a peachy flavour and sometimes quite crisp. Considered to be Spain's premier quality white wine. Do you know what the grape is? Clues after the news. So let's get straight to the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Well, the fear of swine flu has led a Catholic church in Sydney, Australia, to stop offering sacramental wine at Holy Communion until the public health risk is eliminated. Instead, they'll only be offered bread. In Australia, 7 people are in intensive care out of the 1,400 confirmed swine flu cases across the country. And Melbourne has 10 times as many cases as Sydney, but the diocese defended the decision as common sense.
Discussions on Holy Communion wine are not limited to Australia. Even in little old Twickenham, after an outbreak of swine flu at a nearby school, my local church discussed measures to minimise infection, including not giving out wine. No great loss, though. The quality of the wine is often watered down and technically not very good. What's next, Jane?
Well, vineyard plantings in the UK continue to increase. That's according to the latest DEFRA figures, which show there are 1,106 hectares now under vine, the highest ever recorded, showing a growth of 45% in the last 4 years. Vineyards are also on the up at 416. The figures were collated after the 2008 harvest by the Wine Standards Branch of the Food Standards Agency, which holds the Vineyard Register. All vineyards must be listed on the register when they come into production. This means that vineyards which are planted but not yet in production aren't all registered. And an estimate by Stephen Skelton, MW, estimates that the planted area in 2008 was actually closer to 1,250 hectares. In addition, another 100 hectares of vines were planted in 2009. Skelton's also evaluated the different varieties planted, with a marked increase in the traditional Champagne varieties. Pinot Noir accounts for 19% of the total, and Chardonnay at 17%, with Bacchus the third most planted grape at 10% of the area under vine. The top two varietals are used primarily for sparkling wine, which confirms fizz is very much the focus for the English wine trade.
I've just read Stephen Skelton's report on the UK wine scene for Tom Stevenson's 2009 Wine Report, which is going to be our next book review in a couple of weeks' time. It does appear as if we're marching to a bubbly world. I do hope that Bacchus manages to keep its plantings up and we continue to make some fantastic rosés, which is great if you're a Wimbledon fan. Talking of Wimbledon, the rosé to drink in 2008 is Chapel Down English Rose. It's available from the supermarkets. Don't get the 2007, which you may find in some Waitrose stores as it's falling to bits. But the 2008 is great. What's the last story, Jane?
Our last story, some of you may recall the Glassright Wine Project, which was being run by RAP, the Waste and Resources Action Programme. They've saved over 20,000 tonnes of glass since 2006, and the project has increased bulk imports of wine to the UK by over 90 million litres, with around 115 million glass bottles now filled in the UK. The UK is the world's largest importer of wine, buying in some 1.6 billion bottles every year, which in turn leads to 630,000 tonnes of glass entering the UK's waste stream and creating a significant CO2 emissions through transportation. Through the project, RAP is seeking to reduce this impact by collaborating with the supply chain to encourage the use of lighter weight bottles and the bulk importation of wine. That's all this week. Don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. We'll be talking to Nicola Jenkins from RAP after the spotlight. I was planning on finishing the Spotlight series on wine and food matching, looking at red meats, but I sat in on that great tasting with Bruno Guiers, the chef de cave at Moët & Chandon. His job was basically to make the wines and assemble them. I'd actually been hoping to record an interview with him, but it turned out we didn't have time in the end. But I did get some great insights with you, which I thought I'd share in this week's Spotlight. We tasted a lot of different wines, mainly the components that make up the sparkling wines. So I got to try Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, the Rosés, all the wines before he'd assembled the wines and gone through the second fermentation, which I thought was really interesting. For the non-vintage blend, he blends it 3 or 4 times a year. According to him, wines age quite a bit during the year, and for example, at the moment, using 2008 vintages, when he first started using 2008 vintages, he used a lot of the 2006 reserve wine to get that aging in the wine. But as the 2008 vintage aged and got older, he was using less and less reserve wine as the year passes. He does this to get consistency throughout the year. His view is that non-vintage wines should be drunk fairly quickly after purchase. And in France, where they prefer these wines younger, this would be essential, as opposed to in the UK, where he thinks we prefer slightly older and oxidised wines. Moët started producing rosé back in 1996, and typically they use about 20-25% of red wine to make a rosé wine, which he says is expensive to make because you need ripe tannins to make red wines, and that means you need to run the grapes at a lower yield to ensure ripeness throughout. Moët and Chandon have an interesting system for extracting colours, though. For Pinot Noir, it's fairly straightforward. Leave the skins in contact with the juice, macerate for 5 to 10 days to extract colour, flavour from the skins. While for Pinot Meunier, they heat the berries up to 70 degrees, which helps release the colour, but not the tannins. Then the Pinot Meunier gets about 2 hours maceration. This technique evolved from thermovinification, which they've used since the 1970s, involving heating grapes to destroy an oxidative enzyme that can come from grapes infected with botrytis. The downside to making good wines from rotten grapes, according to Barrett, is they tend to have a very short shelf life, so no good for, say, vintage champagnes. The other issues associated with improvements have mainly been driven by technology, such as using planes and satellite photography to map the vigour of the vines by looking at the different colours of green in the vineyard. Not surprisingly, they're also looking at yeast strains which they use to inoculate their wines. Originally, the yeast was selected from the vineyards in the 70s and 80s, but with riper grapes coming in, the yeast may not necessarily be the most optimum for the new style of grapes arriving. So Moët and Chandon, they're in the process of looking at their yeast strains again. It was interesting that Barrow was unsure if the change was due to global warming or improved viticultural practices, or a bit of both. One year that stood out was the incredibly hot 2003, where Barrow admitted struggling with low acidity in his 2003 vintage. His solution was to use tannins to freshen the wine on the finish. I think that's tapping his cap to the techniques used in Domaine Chandon in the US and Australia. It's also a technique that Jacobs Creek's Phil Laffer told us a wee while ago that they use. Barrett did talk quite a bit about reductive versus oxidative winemaking, and at Moët they use both techniques at different points of vinification for different varieties and different blends. This is right through to the choice of oxygen ingress on their bear cap that they use to age the wines in their cellars. Something I was surprised to hear about was that toasty, smoky flavours in champagne is a reductive tasting note. That is, it forms when the wines are kept away from oxygen. I'm not sure why, but I've always thought this to be an oxidative note and maybe to do a wee bit with barrels, so interesting that he thinks it's reductive. I asked Barrett about unpleasant Marmite notes in some of the wines that I've tried, and I asked him about what it was, and he wasn't quite sure, but he suggested it was probably associated with too warm a cellaring, so the cellars were too warm while the wine was on the lees, or maybe that the wine was a bit reductive and suffered from not enough oxygen during fermentation. Either way, including tasting the individual wines before blending and an interesting range of wines, I found it one of the most interesting Tudor tasting I'd been to for ages, and I thought I might share it with you guys. Next week, we're back to our normal spotlight, looking at the last part of our food and wine matching, red meats and wine. But before we have the interview, how are you getting on with those clues? I've got a couple more clues for our mystery grape. So here we go. This white wine has a thick skin, enabling it to withstand the damp climate, and the subsequent fruit is small, sweet, and high in glycerol, producing wines in high alcohol and acidity. It's primarily grown in Rias Baixas, just north of Portugal on the west coast, and some consider it to be a long-lost cousin of the German Riesling grape, brought to Spain by Spanish monks. However, no DNA fingerprinting has been carried out yet to prove this. Known in Portugal as Alvarinho, it's often used as a blending component in Vinho Verde. Hope that helps. Have we think about it anyway while we talk with Nicola Jenkins from RAP. Hi, I'm here with Nicola Jenkins from RAP. How are you, Nicola?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. What we're going to talk about today is a wee bit about some of the different packaging options, such as PET or PET glass, and some of the issues associated with recycling glass and what we do with recycled glass. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a wee bit about PET. Obviously, in trying to minimise glass waste or landfill waste,
yes.
PET is a very lightweight container. It's quite volumetric.
Yeah.
Still a lot of volume there, but quite lightweight. Do you guys encourage PET, or what's your position on it?
What RAP focus on very much is, when one looks at the waste hierarchy, is reduction and minimisation. And that's not always about just solid weight transfer from one bottle type, so glass to PET. That's really a choice for the brand to make. So what we really do is we very much focus looking at a particular material and what you can do within that material. So RAP doesn't necessarily encourage switching from one material to the next. However, what RAP do encourage is when you are thinking of making a switch, because PET is not the only material that wine could go into. There's liquid cartons. Some of you would be very familiar with Tetra Pak, and that's got getting a growing precedence. Bag and box or bib is increasing, and a whole number of others. Aluminium cans, all these sorts of things. Is ultimately for you as a brand is to ask the question, does this still maintain brand equity? Does it ultimately, and in terms of environmental reasons, have a net environmental benefit? And when you put wine in a PET wine bottle, you're certainly going to get that weight reduction. So some work we did with Sainsbury's and Foster's with their Wolf Blass brand recently on PET is a PET bottle weighs 54 grams, whereas an average wine bottle weighs 488 grams.
PET doesn't get recycled as much.
It actually does to a degree. The one,
not now, council.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is it's a very good point you raise, is councils vary. Glass, historically, has got a really good pickup. So a lot of councils collect it. They might not collect it curbside, but there'll be bottle banks and churches and car parks. But what's interesting with PET, and this is something a lot of people don't realise, is if you're going to use PET and you want to design it for recyclability, for want of a better word, is to use quite often PET that is clear. So what the equivalent of Flint. The reason is that those councils that do collect PET will take that. Whereas quite a lot of PET that's used for wine bottles has that greeny colour.
Yep.
Sometimes that's referred to as jazz PET, and that's not as easily recycled. And quite often, if it is recycled, it can't go into what's called closed loop. So it can't go back into food-grade recycled content and be made into another PET wine bottle or an M&S juice drink or whatever it might be. It will go into flower pots, benches, etc. And that's quite significant because it means that your environmental impact is actually going to be reduced. But it does have, going lighter does have some good environmental benefits when it comes to transport, because you're transporting less weight around, and therefore in essence you should be reducing your fuel consumption of your trucks. Quite often, lighter wine bottles made in PET are shorter and their circumference is smaller. So often you can get more wine bottles made of PET or Tetra Pak or liquid cartons because they're square. You can get a better, what's called a cube ratio on a truck.
So you get more density.
Exactly. Yes.
Sure. You mentioned a couple other things like aluminium cans, which I know some Prosecco producers were trialing aluminium a couple of years
ago.
And
Rexham,
They used Paris Hilton to advertise it.
Yes,
great look. That was, I think that was just before she went into jail.
Not so good PR.
Yeah, exactly. And there's obviously Tetra Pak, which we've actually interviewed Ben Rock Station on the show before about their Tetra Paks.
Yeah.
They're almost impossible to recycle Tetra Pak. Do you consider Tetra Pak to be a good product?
That is something I can't comment on technically, because I'm not an expert on that. What I can comment on about Tetra Pak, and that's a term that often is quite confusing, because Tetra Pak is one of many companies that make what are called liquid cartons. There are about three companies that make...
I don't think a Tetra Pak is a brand. I think it more is a product.
Yes.
It's one with the cardboard, the aluminium,
and
a plastic layer.
Yes. So in the industry, those are called liquid cartons, and there are a number of companies that make them. What's interesting with that is Tetra Pak have actually worked very hard with a lot of UK local authorities to increase the collection of Tetra Paks. So according to Tetra Pak and some work that we've done, more than 65% of local authorities in the UK actually can collect liquid cartons.
Can or do?
I can and do. That I don't know the exact, but they can collect it. The reason we know that is because RAP have recently launched with the British Retail Consortium something called on-pack labelling. And in order to have a certain type of logo that says your product is widely recyclable, more than 65% of local authorities have to collect that product. And that is the case for liquid cartons.
The only use I've heard for liquid cartons or Tetra Pak is egg cartons. Being recycled into air cartons. Great that they collect them, but what can you do with them?
I think, again, that's a question actually for the liquid carton manufacturers. But what we can say is that the liquid cartons that are collected do get exported to the continent because there are no recycling facilities in the UK. And there they are broken down into the different elements. The fibre, the paper fibre, is actually a high-quality fibre, and that is quite regularly and well-received by reprocessors who use recycled content. Mm-hmm. So it's in terms of the actual nature of what happens to the aluminium and the other elements, I suppose there are different markets for that.
All right. So we've talked a wee bit about what happens to PET, and in another show we looked at what happened to glass as it got recycled. Mm. What are the big uses for recycled glass? Does it all go back into these green bottles? I know some of it goes into the road. Mm. What about stuff that's exported overseas? And the idea of exporting glass overseas to recycle seems like an awful waste of carbon.
Yeah. Funny enough, it's not always. And RAP have carried out some really interesting pieces of research looking at various LCAs, life cycle analyses, on transporting PET and a number of things to places like China, etc. And the environmental impact is not as large as it is made out to be. But I don't want to detract by going off on that one. What's really interesting is with recycling of glass bottles, most of the wine bottles that come into the UK are bottled in green, and we want to use that glass again. So what we are doing is we are working with the glass manufacturers to encourage them to manufacture more wine bottles. And how do we do that? We have to have a market for them. How do we do that? We encourage the increase of bulk importation into the UK so that they can manufacture green bottles with a high recycled content. So all those bottles we put in the curbside have a home to go to. And they don't have to get shifted or sent over to France or to Portugal, which is a common place for those green bottles.
How much is recycled in the UK versus how much is exported for recycling, for green bottles?
That I don't know the exact percentages.
Rough feel for
it? Oh, you're putting me on the spot there. But what I do know is it's not as high as we would like it to be. What's quite interesting, though, is what's called closed loop, so making a product that it was into the same product, is that a lot of the glass that might go to France or that goes to Portugal is very likely to be sold back in the UK again. Mm. So, and you know, the distances are not huge between France and Portugal. So it's not as significant as if you're transporting from the New World.
What about UK winemakers?
Yes.
You know, we do a lot about UK wine on the show.
Yes.
And the nice thing about UK wine is there's quite a lot of green glass used for sparkling wine. And sparkling wine bottles are up the high end of the, you know, closer to your kilo a bottle type thing because of the increased pressure.
Yes.
Have you got any programs to encourage the larger? Because there's five or six really big producers in the UK.
Yes. It's an area we tend not to focus, because as mentioned before, our focus has very much been on the volume producers. However, that doesn't say that we're not working with the small industries, and we do have WSP Environmental, who are contracted as the project managers on Glasswright Wine, and they are engaging with the UK wine industry, although I have to say that hasn't been our focus to date. Having said that, you mentioned sparkling wine, and we've actually just set up a champagne and sparkling wine task group, much to the jealousy of some of my colleagues. Little do they know that it probably won't really benefit me. But we are going to be working very much there with the UK sparkling wine industry, and there's a retailer we're currently working with who buy UK sparkling wine, and we're actually working with them on lightweighting their bottles as well. So watch the space. I wish I could reveal who that is, but that's really exciting work. The one interesting thing, if I just might put, is that lightweighting with bottles.
Isn't it?
No, it's not. Don't try and get it off me. But it's
well,
not Waitrose.
Let me have another guess. There's only four to choose from.
And I'm a government-funded organisation, so I'm not open to bribes. So basically, what's interesting with lightweighting champagne bottles and sparkling wine bottles is you've got to remember they're bubbles, and you've got to have a good, strong product to hold those bubbles. Mm. But there's still room for change.
Yep. Mm. I would have thought that, particularly with some of the manufacturers, are really starting to get quite big volumes. You know, and there's three or four that are actually producing decent volume that you'd think that if you targeted them, you could get, you know, more than a couple of kilos off your target.
No, that's a good point,
You said that at least one UK retailer is looking to lightweight their green glass from UK wines, which is quite nice. There's a thing, and you talked about it before the interview, about greenwashing, which is, I presume, is making yourself look green, but not actually doing a lot.
Exactly, exactly.
How much have the big, and it's probably mainly the supermarkets here, you know, are they really getting behind it, or are they more of a put a bit of greenwash up?
That's again a good question, and some of you might be aware of what's called the Courtauld Commitment.
No.
The Courtauld Commitment is a wrap set of objectives that all 92% of the UK retail sector have signed up to. So the Tesco, Sainsbury's, M&S, the Cooperative, you name it, they've signed up to this. And the main objective of that commitment is to reduce packaging weight. And we've set a number of objectives, and one of them was to reduce packaging waste being produced by the retail sector by 2008. And we actually hit that. And I know, because I had to calculate all the numbers and spent my weeks in spreadsheets, so I do know we hit it. But that's across all types of packaging.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is when retailers start to look at where's the biggest weight, if we're just looking at weight, it's wine bottles. And so a lot of them have spent a lot of effort and time on wine bottles. So some very good examples would be Tesco, who have reduced their wine bottles in total by over 2,000 tons of glass, which is significant. You've got the Cooperative. They are small, but they say they've reduced their wine bottles by a total of 1,000 tons. Sainsbury's sit on our Glasswright Wine Steering Group. We got other supporters from M&S, etc. So a lot of them, and Asda, are also, and they're not only just looking at lightweighting of wine bottles, which a lot have already started to do, but they're actually looking at increasing bulk importation because it makes good business sense for them as well.
What about the large wine specialists like the Majestics or Odbins? Have any of those been involved in any of the initiatives?
Not at this stage. We've had to really decide on where to focus our attention. That's not to say that we haven't opened up dialogue with them. We have. But our focus has been very much on the bigger brands. So we've worked very closely with Constellation Europe, Foster's, etc., and then the bigger retailers, because again, that's where the biggest volume is. However, we have been in dialogue with a lot of the names that you've just mentioned.
Okay. All right, so it sounds like you're really cherry-picking, and hopefully that'll trickle down to the smaller things eventually.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right then, Nicola, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much.
I hope you've enjoyed our look at wine recycling and packages. Next week, we're going to have a wee look at some wine regions around the US, starting with the New York wine region. I did have a really nice email from John in the Loire Valley, who says he's a big fan of the show, and he had a few ideas for the show for me. He wanted me to have a look at maybe wine auctions. And I have already recorded a show with Sotheby's, which I'll be releasing probably in about 2 months' time. So already on there. He also said he's just about to listen to show 160 and is actually finding the recycling topic pretty interesting. He mentions an interesting fact that after last week's show, he looked at his recycling box, and in France, where he lives, they don't separate the different coloured glass out, which surprised John a bit. In response, I suppose in France, they're not so desperate to separate out the glass in the waste stream. As you can imagine, they have a huge demand for green glass, which they export to all over the world. So the additional cost of separation is probably not worthwhile, given that they can probably consume most of the recycled glass for their wine industry. In the UK, where we import large amounts of green glass but have no real use for it, it's a low-value commodity compared to maybe clear glass, where we have a lot more use for it. So it's more important to separate the green glass from the clear glass to maintain value in clear glass. Because as Paul said, once it's mixed up, it can only really be used for green glass. Thanks very much for your comments, John. I do appreciate them. It's a shame that John's not in the UK, being in the Loire Valley, because I have some free tickets to Toast Festival coming up next weekend. Toast is a music and wine festival with an Antipodean twist. Being a Kiwi, that's good for me. They're all held at Clapham Common in London and start on Friday the 26th of June with South African Day. Saturday is New Zealand Day and Sunday is Australia Day. There's lots of wine, food and sort of local cultural events going on. If you'd like to attend, send me an email with your name and your physical mail address so I know where to send them, and the day you'd like to attend and how many tickets you'd like. Maximum of 2 per person. I have about 5 pairs to give away on each day, so be quick. Email me at chris.scott@3050.co.uk, or you can get hold of me through my Facebook account. Also, if you are emailing me, do give me some comments about the show. It'd be great to get them, especially how you're going with those different grapes and regions. I think it's a lot better than guessing the quote, but hopefully it's educational as well. I actually thought maybe changing it around a wee bit to make it a wee bit more educational. So I'm going to tell you what the mystery grape is now, and then I'm going to go through all the hints we gave you just to help you remember what the grape variety is. It is the Spanish grape Albarino. So here are the clues again. Albarino is a perfumed, elegant wine making peachy, fleshy, crisp wines. Considered Spain's premier quality white wine, and Albarino has a thick skin, which enables it to handle the damp climatic conditions in northwest Spain. Its thick skin also means that it creates small, sweet berries. They're high in glycerol and produce wines with high in alcohol and acidity. It is primarily grown in Rías Baixas in the northwest of Spain and on Portuguese west coast. Some consider it to be the German Riesling grape brought to Spain by monks. However, no DNA fingerprinting has been carried out to prove this. Albarino is also known in Portugal as Alvarino and often used as a component in Vino Verde. Hopefully, hearing the grape or region clues at the end may help you remember it if you hadn't quite worked it out as we went through. Only thing left to say now is the quote, this time from Oscar Wilde. Work is the curse of the drinking classes. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.